Thank you for being here, everyone. This is Coffee Chats with Researchers. I am Katie Butner, and in the conversation you're going to hear today, I'm speaking with Dr. Claire Renzetti, who brings an immense amount of experience and a dedication to bringing good work to the field. And I say that because, as you'll hear in the first just minute of our conversation, that Dr. Renzetti holds a ton of hats and hats that are very dedicated to sharing the work of others. So I think it's a really interesting and a really important conversation. But also we get to hear about her own scholarship and a recent evaluation of a therapeutic horticultural program, which I think is something that can have an incredible impact on communities and something that we haven't gotten to talk about a lot on these episodes. I think it's a great one to tune into. Grab your coffee, grab your tea, maybe your homegrown herbal tea, and enjoy this episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers. Thank you so much for being here with me today. Can you give an introduction to yourself and just who you are, what you do, and kind of what you bring to this conversation today?
My name is Dr. Claire Renzetti, and I am professor and chair of sociology at the University of Kentucky, where I'm also the Judy Conway Patton Endowed Chair for Studies on Violence Against Women in the Center for Research on Violence Against Women. I'm also editor of the International Interdisciplinary Journal, Violence Against Women, and I edit two book series, one on gender and justice for University of California Press, and one on gender-based and family violence for Cognella, which is more of a textbook handbook series, whereas the gender and justice is more research monographs. And then I co-edit with Jeff Bettelsen a series for Oxford University Press on interpersonal violence. And those are mostly research monographs, but also anthologies made up of chapters that report on various research studies around a central theme.
So just like a couple things, just like some light work.
Well, I left out my own research.
Yeah.
I spend a lot of time with other people's research. And I have to say, I love that. I really love editing. I've been doing it for a long time. Violence Against Women is in its 28th year. And I'm the founding editor. Sage owns the journal, so it's not affiliated with a society or a professional organization. Sure. And we publish now 16 times a year, and we're receiving close to 800 submissions a year.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
It's wonderful. Well, thanks. It's exciting. I really love helping people get good work in other people's hands. Mm. Sort of like what you're doing with this project. You want to share good work being done. So yeah, I spend a lot of time on other people's work, but I'm just finishing up an OVW-funded project. Diane Follingstead is my co-partner in this. We're the co-PIs. And it's an evaluation of the therapeutic horticulture program at our local battered women's shelter, Greenhouse 17. That shelter used to be called the Bluegrass Domestic Violence Project. And several years ago, they changed it to Greenhouse 17 because of the importance of the farm project in what they do. They cultivate lots of crops and they use them in their own kitchen. The last couple of years, they hired a real chef who also teaches the residents about food prep and knows something about nutrition. And they have a farm manager. And the women work out on the farm. And what they noticed, gosh, I guess about 8-9 years ago, was that the women who volunteered to work on the farm, who went out and actually dug in the dirt and, you know, weeded and watered and cultivated the crops and then harvested them and then did stuff with them, not necessarily all of those things, but that were hands-on, that they seemed to do better in shelter if they had substance use problems. They seem to stay sober. They seem to get along better with other people. They became more engaged and they had a much more optimistic outlook on their future. But the only evidence they had of any of this was anecdotal. Like, hey, did you see so-and-so? You know, she's just so proud of what she grew and she's just really thriving. And so, of course, they wanted to keep the farm going and they wanted to support it, not just on donations, but get some funding for it. And so we saw a great opportunity to partner with them. We had been doing work out there anyway, and we thought, well, let's see if we can get this funded and do a formal evaluation. And it's now in its last year. We did one no-cost extension pre-COVID, And then COVID happened. And that was sort of like, you can't go anywhere near the shelter.
Right.
Because everything was hands-on pretty much. I mean, we did interviews in person. We did observations out in the field. I mean, we were there and it was a really tough time. And so that stopped. And then we were finally able to go back. We got another 1 year no-cost extension. So it will finish up June 30th. And we just have piles of data to analyze. But it has been a wonderful, wonderful experience. And the graduate student who we have working out at the shelter has just been fantastic. And she has developed relationships with the staff there. And she will periodically go to their staff meetings and give them updates on what's happening. And then we're going to be presenting the data at the American Society of Criminology meeting in November. And she's also going to be doing a presentation for the shelter folks in the fall too, once we have more data analyzed. So that's been a big part of our time. And then the other project I've been working on, we have data on college students' assessments of just punishments in campus sexual assault cases. And it was a vignette study, and we varied certain conditions. And right now we're looking at some really fascinating data. One of the conditions was whether there were medical consequences to the assault. And each one of these vignettes describes what is legally a sexual assault. It's rape. Many of the students who respond don't necessarily see it as rape. And they know what consent is. They clearly know all the rules. They've learned this in, you know, freshman orientation and their various prevention programs. And they could recite that for you chapter and verse. But then when they actually evaluate a case, they have very different opinions of what consent is, which is interesting. But this particular set of data is about whether there were no medical consequences, whether the young woman contracted an STI from the assault, whether she got pregnant from the assault, and how students view that in terms of guilt, responsibility, the victim and the perpetrator, they're rated separately, and severity of punishment. And then they choose a punishment from a list of, I think there's 13 of them that are actual sanctions that the university can impose. That we had a student group of samples, college students, evaluate in terms of severity and rank order them, not the ones that are in the study. But anyway, we're looking at the data now and some of the other conditions. We sent a manuscript out recently about discrepant stories. You know, he said, she said, he admitted it, but said, gee, I really thought she consented, or he admitted it and blamed her, something like that. And these have been really interesting findings. Yeah. I think they're going to be really useful in terms of informing prevention programs, because students are getting it in terms of what the policies are. But when it comes to actual cases, they're not necessarily getting it. So
yeah,
it's really interesting. We have a lot of data from that as well.
So all of it, it's an incredible scope of work from both the elements that you're serving in, what I'll call more administratively or from like an editor perspective, and then to active data collection. So there's a lot there. There's a lot of really interesting things that you have in the works. I wonder if you could speak a bit to what you're hoping, or with the active data collection elements, what are you hoping to see come from that? Or what are you most excited in both of those projects of like what you're seeing emerge from the data?
Well, with the therapeutic horticulture project.
It sounds like such an incredible program.
It's really interesting. Anybody had told me I would be studying this.
Right. Like,
I look at a plant and it dies, right? The plant nurseries won't let me buy plants, you know, because they think it's cruel to the plant.
Thank you, but no thank you. Right, yeah.
They look and they're like, wait, turn her away. But it's really, really been interesting. And it's so exciting to see the women get excited about it and to do well. And it's helped the shelter because, you know, they were talking about how the budget was the biggest part of spending, right? And it wasn't necessarily nutritious. Nutritious food. And this is homegrown vegetables.
Yeah.
They also have flowers. They also cultivate flowers and they do a flower CSA in the summer. They sell the products down at the farmers market in downtown Lexington. And also they do flowers for weddings. And they also make some products with the herbs, the herb garden. They have a meditation garden that's part of the farm. It's really neat. And they make soaps. You can go to greenhouse17.org, I believe.
Okay.
That's the website, and you'll see all the information about the farm. And what we're hoping is that, well, the preliminary results that we've analyzed so far, we haven't gotten through all the years of data, but the early preliminary analyses indicate that all of the women who participate in shelter services, you know, support groups and various things, they and the women who do the therapeutic horticulture, all the women seem to have improvements in self-esteem, self-efficacy, those things that we're measuring, but that the women who participate in the therapeutic horticulture program actually do a bit better.
Sure.
Their outcomes are better. And that's what we were hoping to see. We weren't sure we were going to see it.
Mm-hmm.
It's really voluntary if you want to go out there. So to some extent, women are self-selecting, you know, to go and work. It might be something they find particularly rewarding. We also pay them. So that's an incentive. They get a salary and they get a bonus if they complete 6 weeks. And so there is the financial incentive. So some of them may want that. But we're hoping that it will help the shelter get more funding to support the farm, because we really think it's an important program. We're also hoping that people will see that other shelters, for example, that it's not something you have to have a farm to do, because this started as container garden.
Oh, amazing.
Some of the therapeutic horticulture programs, this is the only one we know of at a shelter. Some have been done at juvenile justice facilities, at veterans facilities, been done with people who are residents of psychiatric hospitals. Some of them have done rooftop gardens. They've done in urban areas, they've cultivated lawns.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or a backyard or a strip of common ground.
Sure.
In the neighborhood. You don't need a farm. You don't need what 60 acres that we have, which isn't all used for farmland anyway. But it's been amazing to watch. And now the shelter has opened some transitional housing in the form of cottages on the property. They have a kitchen where they do the body products, where they make the body. The kitchen is not certified for food preservation.
Okay.
But it is for soaps and lotions and lip balms and things like that. And that's what they make in there. And just to see it grow. And see the innovation and the excitement, because there was some concern when they were first thinking about this, especially by the staff. Like, oh, no, we have to do all of the work we normally do. And now we're going to be farmers, too.
Right, right. Yeah. Like, I'm not sure that I'm equipped for this.
Right, exactly. But they hired a farm manager, and then they have two other people who work on farm supervision. And it's turned out really well. And then the women go out more. The staff has enough to go out more, because some people like it. And so we're hoping that we can show that this is an option for other shelters if they want to try it and they don't need to have a farm. And also that it will help Greenhouse 17 get more funding to sustain, at least sustain the farm program, if not expand it. And also that people who are serving other types of traumatized populations, we'll see if there's support for this, and it may reinforce their findings, or it may encourage them to try a therapeutic horticulture program with their own populations. We're hoping to reach that. And with the What is Justice Project, with the students, we really do hope that the findings will influence prevention programming on college campuses than even high schools, because students are learning what they have to learn, but that doesn't necessarily translate into behavior or even perspectives, judgments of other students and what occurs. There's still a lot of victim blaming that goes on after all the years that we've talked about this and tried to educate students about this, not just in prevention programs that they have to take, but also in our classrooms.
Yeah.
You know, I talk about this in my classes, so they learn it for the test, I guess.
Right. What you started when you were mentioning that they know what consent is. And so the being well-versed from the programs that already exist, it's the translation from I have the knowledge to it's integrated into my belief system seems like the key component that remains lacking, maybe, or remains in need of attention.
I mean, don't get me wrong. A lot of students said, this is rape. This is wrong. This deserves punishment.
Yeah.
So there's a good number of students. It's just surprising to us how many students don't say that. And they say things like, well, she was drinking, or, you know, she let him on, or something like that. You know, and you're sitting there thinking, wait a minute, you know, chapter and verse, what affirmative consent is, you know? And so we're really hoping that we can talk more about what sorts of programming might be more effective,
sure,
or how we can address these types of issues.
Do you have, I guess, initial thoughts or ideas about that? I know that I'm asking you to kind of do what maybe us as researchers don't like to do, which is to talk about something before we have all the information.
Yeah.
But I think for the just even from your perspective, from your vast experience of saying, you know, even though I'm not fully fact supported in this yet, what I'm hoping to see or what it's making me think about maybe is paying attention to this area more or implementing different programs like this.
Yeah. Well, one thing it's made me think about is the efficacy of these mandatory online things that you have to do before they can register or before they can come to campus or something. And we know that some of them are signing in, letting the thing run, you know, and it's like what they, I hate to say this, but it's what I've found some students do with online courses, period.
Sure.
You know, and you call on somebody and they're not there. Their camera's not on and they're not there, right?
Yeah.
So it's really made me question how much those types of programs, trainings or whatever are making a difference and having an impact on students. So I guess I'm saying I'm not providing an alternative yet.
Mm-hmm.
But what I'm saying, it's making me question what we do right now. I think we need to be a bit more innovative. Think about where students are right now. And I'm hoping this gives us some insight into how students think about this stuff.
I think what you're saying about, especially the mandated courses that I guess like I can speak anecdotally being on the receiving end of those in various capacities and various places, that it is easy to disengage from those. Even hearing you speak to the even occasional difference, like you're saying, it's not every student that's seeing a disconnect between I have the knowledge, but not the application into scenario. But even that still does pose a gap, that it's an indicator. And again, Tim, I'll say it this, but that there is just that ingrained belief system element and that whatever is happening already isn't totally accounting for that need. So there's still a bit of a space to figure out what is going to continue to push the ingrained belief system versus just the book knowledge. What we're looking for ultimately is sort of societal level and like individual level
right.
behavior change. So it's going to take more than the ability to have just the knowledge, right? So
or to log on for 50 minutes and listen to a video and then answer some questions.
You know? Absolutely. It sounds like active data collection projects are they're so practically based, so implementation based, that there's really a lot of action in the results of those that can happen.
Yeah.
And particularly when I think about the college, you know, because here, at least in the role being at a research center at an academic institution, we do a lot of work to understand what is campus climate and how students are experiencing life here. And what you're speaking to sounds just a very informative study because it gets at that, okay, we know we're training you. What are we actually seeing in the behavior element? And that seems very critical to the next level or next layer of what we think of as addressing campus sexual assault.
So.
Yeah. And I mean, based on what you shared in terms of all of the other hats that you hold, that there's a real blend there of the macro and clinical space. Like those are very applied programs versus serving in an editor space or as an endowed chair in a research center. So there's a lot of flow in there. And I think that's a good segue to my next question, which is, can you speak a bit to your journey to the place you are in your career and to what has led you to be what I'll call like the type of researcher that you are, the type of academic that you are now?
Yeah. Now, remember, I'm old, so...
I would say for those folks
a long journey.
True. You're not all
a long journey. So I'll try not to go through the whole journey. So we're not here for a long time. But I came to criminology. It was kind of a funny thing. I've always been interested in crime since I was a kid. I used to play detective when I was a little kid.
Nice.
And I would make up crime scenes. I always read mysteries and stuff. And our poor next door neighbor was always the perpetrator of some crime.
That poor person's got a complex now.
Yeah. And so I grew up with that interest. But when I went to college, I really didn't know what I wanted to major in. And in those days, they didn't do all of the cool stuff they do now for students. You kind of, my orientation was a day, and we were in this big auditorium. They kind of handed you the handbook, which in those days was in print. You know, there was no such thing as an online anything. You stood in line to register for classes and you filled out a form, you know, with a pen. So they hand me the handbook and they say, you know, it has all the majors and the curriculum for each major. And what do you want to do? And I said, well, you know, let me look at it. Right. And so my mom was with me. My mom was a homemaker. My dad sold Pontiacs for like 50 some years. Neither one of them went to college, but I have five siblings and we're each 5 to 6 years apart.
Wow. So,
and my three siblings ahead of me had all graduated from college, all in different fields. Oh. My oldest brother was the civil and nuclear engineer. My second brother was a finance major and pilot. My sister was in English and education. And so they were all different.
Yeah.
And because we were spread apart like that, we weren't real close at that time. Now we're very close. But at that time, we had very different lives.
Sure.
I didn't know what to do. And my mother goes, you know, you're really good with little children. And I said, you know, you're right. And she said, well, here's a major called child development. And I looked at it and I said, oh, this looks really good. And it was in the College of Home Economics. When I play two truths and a lie, I always include my first college major was in the College of Home Economics. And everybody automatically fears that her.
That's not right.
But I won.
Wow.
And so I signed on. After my first semester, I realized that really wasn't for me. So I changed my major to the College of Arts and Sciences to psychology. But I didn't know that there were different types of psychology, you know, that there was clinical and experimental. And our psychology department was pretty heavily experimental. It didn't have a big clinical program. And so I was spending a lot of time with rats.
Yeah.
I really want to work with people. So I took an intro to sociology class just as an elective.
Yeah.
And I had a wonderful, wonderful teacher. And I thought, this is all about people. And I didn't know anything about sociology. And I was like, I think I'm going to take another class. And I saw Introduction to Criminology. And I thought, oh, wow, this, I didn't know you could do this. So I signed up for that. And my teacher was Dr. Frank Scarpitti. And Frank died 3 years ago, but he was my lifelong mentor. In fact, just last week, I found a letter he wrote me when I was promoted to full professor. And he said, how could that young woman who was in my intro to criminology class all those years ago be a full professor now? I just cried when I saw it. He talked to me about criminology and he really encouraged me to go to graduate school. And I always say that he also mentored me in how to be a department chair. He managed all sorts of egos and big egos. You wouldn't think that would be the case in an academic institution, right? But there are some,
right?
I would often talk to him and it was wonderful. And so that got me into criminology and to graduate school. I became very interested. You know, it was the late 70s and so the women's movement and everything. And I was really interested in that. And women was a big part of that. And so I did my master's thesis on rape crisis counseling. So again, it was practical. I worked in crisis counselors and spent time in the rape crisis centers. And so I just became very, very interested in violence against women and continued my research in that area. But I've always felt that I find data collection and data analysis intrinsically interesting. It excites me. I get so excited when I see data. You know, this is so exciting. But I also feel like I shouldn't be doing research just out of curiosity or just for research's sake. I want to create usable knowledge. It's what I call purposive research with a purpose and it's usable. I think that that has been a motivator to me that I love data collection analysis, but I want it to make a difference in some way. And I know that's the cliche, but it's true. I mean, it's the way I feel. I really want somebody to be able to use my research for a practical purpose of making someone's life or some group's lives better. And I hope that all the work I've done over the years has had that impact.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. It's quite a path and a story and kind of like a fun one, you know, like there's a lot of good, a lot of excitement, a lot of enthusiasm in there and a lot of figuring it out a bit. Being able to see opportunities also in the folks that you were surrounded by.
I had good people helping me. Yeah. I really did. And I have to say that even though they always said, you're all going to go to college, you know, and three of us have graduate degrees, three of the five, they didn't necessarily understand what we were doing, but they were so supportive and so proud. And it didn't matter that I was a girl. You know, they said, you can do whatever you want. And they always supported me. I don't think to the day she died, my mother knew what I actually did.
My mother is the same. They've not really... I do like adjunct lecturing at the university. And I think that's kind of the best thing that she can grasp on though, is just be like, oh, you're teaching. And I'm like, it's the thing I do as the part-time job, but sure. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. She would tell all of her friends, oh, she's a teacher at a university, you know?
Yeah.
That's it. Yep. That's what I do. I remember giving her a copy of a book that I did one time. She looked at it and she said, oh, I'm so proud of you that you did this book, but do you think sometime you could research something nice? I think she was worried about me, you know, being involved with the really dark stuff and it being depressing or scary or unsafe. And then when I became a mother, I kind of understood that. They were very, very supportive of me and I had lots of supportive people.
Yeah.
The year, including the siblings who we always kind of help one another. And so as we got older, we cheer each other on, which is great. So,
yeah. With that experience and with, you know, I think what is the valuable element of longevity in the field is also being able to see the shifts in priorities, the shifts in thinking, the ways in which we continue to critique even the foundations of our knowledge, as we should in every field, but being in the violence against women field, seeing us continue to expand and evaluate and grow from where we place our roots to where we are today. And that journey will be fascinating to see continue.
I think, too, that the violence against women field is really special in that it has always been interdisciplinary and collaborative. You know, sociologists are always trained to work as individual scholars. And in the violence against women field, you learn very, very quickly that you have to keep turning that prism to understand the problem.
Sure.
And so I've been really lucky to work with, well, at the Center for Research on Violence Against Women, I mean, Ann Coker, Diane Fallingstead, Heather Bush, you know, just really smart, incredibly talented researchers from different disciplines. I mean, Heather's a biostatistician, Ann's an epidemiologist, Diane's the clinical and forensic psychologist. So sitting in a room and hearing those different perspectives is critically important. The violence against women in the field overall is really lucky to be interdisciplinary and international, which is because this I had when I started the journal. I said, if we're going to do this, it has to be interdisciplinary. And I think that that's benefited the field a lot in terms of people willing to collaborate across disciplines as opposed to setting up those silos again.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a critical element of us being able to move forward and to continue to learn, especially because we are in a world that is no longer so location-based. It is far more global than it ever has been and will continue to head in that direction. Mm-hmm. So with that, what do you see and sort of with that perspective of you have been able to see the sort of arc of change or the graph of change? What are the biggest gaps or biggest next steps that you see for the work and for the field?
Well, I think that the field has gotten better at looking at diversity issues, but I think we still have a long way to go. And understanding that different people's experiences may not necessarily be bad because they're not like ours. I'm doing a very clumsy job of saying that I get really concerned when we talk about changing culture of our society, but our culture is really diverse. So we're talking about changing the dominant culture. But I get really frustrated and sad sometimes about the fact that when we look at different forms of violence against women, we're often quick to blame those men or that happens in that type of society or that religious tradition or something like that, as opposed to, you know, really trying to understand it and what it says and how we can build on that in terms of prevention and change and things like that. I think we're getting better, but I think lots of times we pay lip service to intersectionality and don't really implement it as well as we could. So I see that still as a gap. And like anything, I think that we often get excited about the bright, shiny penny.
Of course. Yeah.
And off we go. And all the funding goes there. And, you know, and we see tons and tons of studies going out on this one thing and the neglect of other things. And the funding agencies drive that. So I really wish that there could be funding that allows for more innovation. And that's kind of pie in the sky, but I really think that some really innovative ideas are not funded just because they're not in the lane that's currently favorable or or that's being
ultimately what's popular, like what's the topic of the moment.
Exactly. And I think that's a shame because then that takes that work much, much longer to get done. And then it's going to get critiqued more because they're not going to have the sample size and they're not, you know, can they make meaningful comparisons, that sort of thing. And they can only do what their resources allow. So that kind of concerns me. I would really like the field to be politically charged again. We often worry about what we say because sometimes we're worried about losing funding. But I think if anything that the Trump era taught us was that you just can't let that go. We are still dealing with this and we will for a while. It's scary to think of a future where abortion is illegal. And for women in the violence against women field, for researchers, I mean, in the violence against women field, this is super scary because we know about reproductive abortion. We know that some women are forced to get abortions and we know some women are forced to carry pregnancies to term. And we also know that some women get pregnant intentionally and think they want to have this baby, but they're dealing with an abusive partner who gets more abusive.
Right.
And now they don't want to do this, let alone pregnancies from rape and incest. And some states aren't even allowing abortion for that anymore. Yep. I think that we really need to see this as our fight too. I worry that we don't necessarily see it that way and that we're not as politicized as we should be.
Yeah, no one has given that answer yet. And that's a thought-provoking point, and I appreciate it. There's always, again, that space to critique ourselves and say, like, who is it that we want to be in the world? What's the role we want to play? And is the role that we want to play to be totally appropriate on either side of the, I'm like not finding the correct words to use right now, but the idea of just saying, well, okay, this isn't our lane. That's not our lane to be political, you know, or do we want to recognize that inherently the work we're doing is political, whether we want it to be or not?
To some extent, the field has gotten so bureaucratized.
Yeah.
That really bothers me a lot.
And sure.
I'm going to really date myself now, but remember you wouldn't remember the old saying, the personal is political, because you weren't even born yet when that saying. But it really still has such resonance.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where we are right now, it reminds me of like 1973 when they decided Roe v. Wade. Are we really willing to go back? It's really, really upsetting and scary.
It absolutely is. And we could have a whole nother conversation on that perspective. With that, though, and you get at it a little of just the elements of funding. So the last question that I like to ask everyone is, if you had unrestricted dollars to do the work or the research that you wanted or the program, what would it be? What would you do?
So I've already told you, you know, I would take that money and I would give it out to really innovative, I guess you could say risky projects. Some of them are going to fail, but I think that bias against null findings in a research project.
Yeah.
People who don't, you know, get significant results, don't get published.
Right.
Nobody wants to hear about the nonsense. Well, I think we learn as much from what doesn't work and figuring out why it didn't work as we do from positive findings.
Absolutely.
Oh, good. We confirmed our hypotheses. Well, great. But I would really love to have, gosh, unlimited funding, you said. Okay.
So yeah.
Unlimited funding to be able to give it out to people who say, I've got a great idea. And nobody's interested in it. And it might not work, but here's what I think. You know, not just give everybody money, but I'm talking about somebody who create a program or who has a really interesting research question. And right now, they can't get it funded for whatever
reason.
And I would love to be able to say, okay, here's $500,000 or here's $1 million, what they need. And I would look at the budget and all that stuff. I've been on enough NIJ review panels. I know what to look for. But I just think it'd be so cool to be able to do that, to learn from the failures as much as from the successes.
Absolutely.
And why did that happen? happen. That would be my exciting thing.
I think that would be great. I'm not sure if you would feel the same, but when I hear you talk about that, it makes me think of what I see as true, which is that not every one of those innovative programs is also going to be replicable right. and scalable. And we right. always want that. We always are like right. acquiring that to say, yeah. well, if we're going to do this, then we're standardizing a model. And those that can be really great and incredibly useful in a lot of situations. It can also be not helpful and also very limiting and very almost biased, because so often we're not asking the question of like, well, what's the context, both culturally, ethnically, just racially, just like everything that's going in here. Instead, we just prioritize the ability to say, well, we gathered the data that shows that this works. Now let's make it happen in every city across the country. And if you can't say that that's what's happening, then that funding doesn't exist.
We submitted our proposal for the therapeutic horticulture evaluation a couple times before it got funded. And one of the criticisms was, you have to have a farm. I mean, how many shelters are going to, you know, we were like, no, we actually had put in the proposal, no, you don't need a farm. And it took us a while to figure out how to phrase that. Mm-hmm. But it was exactly what you're talking about. It was, well, this is going to be really limited because it's about a farm. It's about farming and not everybody can have a farm. And it was just, this is it. And yeah. there's no way to tweak it or adapt it or innovate. I'm really hoping that we got funded. So yeah. somebody got the message. But that's one of the things that we really want to get across when we talk about our findings, because I can't tell you how many times we've talked about that and somebody will say, well, that sounds great, but how many shelters are going to have a farm?
Right. Exactly. Well, at least some of the moments where we put these things out there, that maybe something will come back to at least one of the ideas that folks have. Yeah. We'll speak them into existence. So,
and listen, if you know of anybody who wants to put me in charge of all that unlimited money, I'm okay with that.
I will let you know you're available. You've got the time.
I'm going to step up to the plate and do that.
Right?
It'll be my next career, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We can sort of let go of a few of those hats and make room for this one. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I really
appreciate it. Oh, Katie, it was wonderful. I really enjoyed the time. Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers. You can always find more of these coffee chats on our website, which is vawconsortium.rutgers.edu. And of course, you can always reach out to us via social media or via email. We are always happy to hear from you with your thoughts, your questions, your feedback, or just generally to give us a hello. As always, stay curious, ask questions, drink coffee, and we will see you for our next episode of Coffee Chats with Researchers.